It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back tomorrow. Coming up, we'll look at the ongoing battle over a house in Fox Point and learn about the mysterious artist behind it and the numerous sculptures that adorn the property. First, Governor Walker made headlines this weekend at the Iowa Freedom Summit in Des Moines. He gave a speech at the event that caused many people to call him the weekend's winner. The overall theme of the speech was that the National Republican Party should go big and bold. After talking about winning the race for governor three times in the last 4 years, he had this advice for Republicans nationwide.
You see, I think that sends a powerful message to Republicans in Washington and around the country. If you're not afraid to go big and go bold, you can actually get results.
Matthew DeFoor was at the event, and he's here to discuss it with us now. He's the state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's covering the governor's potential run for president. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
Rob, thank you so much for having me.
Well, most of us didn't attend this Iowa Freedom Summit. Can you set the stage? What was the atmosphere like there?
Sure. It was held at this 19th century theater building, brick building in downtown Des Moines. You had several hundred conservative activists from around the state gather and watch a slate of two dozen speakers, including many presidential hopefuls, people who have both given a really strong indication that they're running, folks like Senator Ted Cruz from Texas or Chris Christie from New Jersey, Governor Scott Walker. And then you had other folks who were kind of are sort of flirting with a run, people like former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, Donald Trump was there. So you really had the full gamut of people on the right wing of the Republican Party. A lot of the more moderate candidates like Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney, Marco Rubio, they were not there. It was an interesting time, to be sure.
Before we dig deeper into what the governor had to say, did you get the sense that the crowd at this summit was buying what he was selling?
Absolutely. A lot of the commentary today that I'm reading and yesterday pegs Scott Walker as the big winner. And really what that has to do with is the expectations he brought into the event being somewhat low. People didn't think of him as being a real fiery speaker. But the stories he was telling at this event really had the audience on the edge of their seat. They were applauding several times throughout. He ended with a standing ovation. It was definitely a well-received speech.
Well, he talked about his record here in Wisconsin. Let's give a little listen.
Since I was elected governor, we've cut taxes in Wisconsin. We reduced spending. We balanced the budget. We took the power away from the big government special interests, and we put it firmly in the hands of the hardworking taxpayers. That's what we need more of in this great country.
So sounds kind of like a guy who might be running for president, trying to get some support in Iowa.
Yeah, I mean, he's said before that he is seriously thinking about it. There's no doubt that he is not only thinking about it, but very likely going to run. I think some of the commentary afterwards was suggesting that this really is putting him on that firm footing and pathway. So we're just going to be covering every step of the way here as he gets close to announcing a decision, which may not come until the summer. So.
We heard a few of the things there, taxes, unions. What other conservative principles did Governor Walker lay out in this speech?
Well, it was interesting because he didn't really shy away from talking about issues that he avoided during the recent gubernatorial election. He talked about signing pro-life legislation, defunding Planned Parenthood. These are things that when we asked him about it during the recent campaign, he said people aren't talking about those issues, but clearly this crowd in Iowa is that's a message that he thought would appeal to them. And talking to them, talking to people in the audience, it seemed to be a good bet. He also talked about things like expanding gun ownership rights, concealed carry, and Castle Doctrine legislation. He talked about property taxes being lower today than they were when he took office. He talked about putting in place voter ID, although, of course, that's now on hold. But certainly that was an issue that got a really big reaction from the crowd.
All right, we've been talking policy stuff so far, but to capture early primary voters, the personal side, make that personal connection seems to be a key. Did the governor try to do that in Iowa?
Yeah, this speech was very much tailored toward introducing himself to these people. You know, they really didn't know a whole lot about him. You know, we follow things so closely in Wisconsin, we take for granted that, you know, people outside the state really don't know every detail about the governor. They may have heard about his, you know, battles with the unions back in 2011. So he took this opportunity to really, you know, go over sort of his greatest hits on some of these things. He got, you know, one reaction that I thought was really interesting was when he told the story about getting death threats, and he used the line that he used in his recent book about his wife being threatened that someone was going to gut her like a deer, and that there was like an audible gasp from the crowd when he said that. And so it just sort of it reinforced this idea that they don't know all these details, and that they create an interesting character study of somebody who stood up in the face of adversity and you know, even these death threats back in 2011.
And you've said or written that the expectation for the governor was fairly low, as you were just talking about, people don't really know him. Did he exceed that level of expectation?
Right. So Iowa, not just on Saturday, but throughout, seems to be a battle about over expectations. You don't necessarily need to win Iowa, you know, the caucus next year, a year from now, in order to do well in the presidential race, but you certainly don't want to fall below expectations. In 2007, Mitt Romney won the Iowa straw poll in August, and then in the Iowa caucus a few months later, he came in second to Mike Huckabee. You know, second doesn't sound too bad, but for Romney to have won the straw poll and then come in second, he sort of fell below expectations. And Walker, at this event at least, came in with, again, those low expectations that he was sort of Midwestern nice, not a very fiery speaker. And by coming out with his shirt sleeves rolled back and, you know, roaming the stage, connecting with people in the audience, he really proved those critics about his presentation wrong. And so he certainly came off at least as being somewhat fiery and not being boring. So it's the thing about expectations, though, is you can exceed them once, but, you know, it's not necessarily something you can do every time, because those expectations will certainly be higher as he goes forward in this process.
How important, I mean, Iowa's important in general. How important is it to Governor Walker in particular if he does end up running?
Iowa has some significance for Walker because he's from a neighboring state. And that gets into those expectations again, is that he'll have an easier time making trips to Iowa. You know, they talked a lot about how in order to win there, you need to be, you know, you need to visit all 99 counties like Rick Santorum did in 2011. But, you know, again, Rick Santorum may have won the caucus, but where did he go after that? So he's going to be going to New Hampshire in March. He's going to be visiting other states. He's likely not to stake all of his hopes on just Iowa, or at least if he's learning from past presidential campaigns, it doesn't seem like that would be wise. But at the same time, he can't show poorly there and expect to continue to get this kind of buzz that he's getting today.
Okay, this weekend, Iowa, where else? What are his next big non-candidate appearances?
Well, we don't know his full schedule, but the campaign isn't sort of laying it all out for the next several months, and I'm sure they don't even know yet. But you know, he's speaking in Washington D.C. at the end of February at the Conservative Political Action Conference. He's spoken at that conference before, but it's a big headliner kind of event for, you know, all the presidential prospects are going to be there. Trotting out their ideas, talking to conservatives from across the country. And so that'll be another big one. And then, as I mentioned, he's going to New Hampshire in March, which, again, that's the state that holds a primary right after the Iowa caucus next January. So it would be another opportunity to strike in a state where he needs to do well early on in the presidential process, if that's, in fact, what he decides to do.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for having me.
That's Matthew DeForest, state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's covering the governor's potential run for president. He was with us to discuss the Iowa Freedom Summit held this weekend. The House in Fox Point has been the subject of debate and controversy in recent years. It's no ordinary house. For many decades, it was home to the artist Mary Knoll, whose many unique pieces of art dot the front yard. But after her death in 2001, there have been questions over what to do with the property, fueled by tensions between art-seeking tourists and frustrated neighbors who weren't keen about the increased traffic to the area. A relocation of the property is now in the works, a move that's being challenged by some preservationists. But just who was Mary Knoll, and what does the future hold for this unique property? Joining us now to discuss these questions is Barbara Monger. She's a Milwaukee-based artist and printmaker. She's the author of Mary Knoll, Inside and Outside, Biography of the Artist, and she recently co-authored the children's version of that book called Mary Knoll, A Lifetime in Art. Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for asking me.
Well, so let's start with some background. Who was Mary Knoll?
Well, she was an artist who lived her life completely devoted to her art, and she has been called a variety of things, from sophisticated, naive, an outsider artist, vernacular artist, and more recently, art environment builder. In spite of her classical training at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, she appeared to ignore this and worked from her pure creative self in a very personal style, and was free of any desire to be part of the mainstream of art or of life at large. And she defined herself as just an artist, although she was also given the title with the Witch of Fox Point, which I don't think she minded too much.
Well, can you paint us a picture? If you were a passerby or driving by this property, it was your everyday neighborhood, I guess, and then you saw what at her house?
Well, driving by, you would first see a chain link fence, and until several years ago, it was topped by coils of barbed wire to keep out the vandals who were attracted to her yard. And within the fence were 1 3/3 wooded acres that were covered with about 75 pieces of sculpture, mostly concrete sculpture, from heads to dinosaurs to smiling dogs and tall figures and kind of replicas of ruins. And these surrounded a small, modest cottage. It actually was a prefab house that was put there in 1943. And it's a humble little house, but it's embellished with fish and figures and hanging carved heads at the doorway, a door knocker that Mary carved that looks like a hand, and in the trees are hanging the profiles of many faces. They're about 3 feet high, and they originally were she made as part of a fence of 400 of these profiles. And also hanging in the trees are wind chimes. So when you walk by the house, you hear these chimes tinkling, and you hear the waves washing up on the beach, and you really get a sense of where Mary's iconography came from. It's mostly fish and boats, little people in boats, and they all come from her love of the lake and from the place where she created these.
Clearly a different kind of house, a different kind of person. Is that, you mentioned that some in the neighborhood jokingly, maybe seriously, thought of her as the witch of the neighborhood. Is that where that came from?
Well, I think the children and teenagers who were attracted and also frightened by her house and yard gave her that name. And I think it was not without good reason. She was a kind of a tall figure who was always working out in the yard when the weather was good, or maybe up on the roof adding things to the house. And she was a very frugal person, and when her clothes got old, she painted them and just kind of spruced them up. And I think her physical presence was a little intimidating, as well as the appearance of the house. And the house, the trees have grown up around the yard, and so it's kind of shadowy, shady, and has a kind of haunting appearance. So probably was a logical term to to call her this.
What was she like as a person, not just viewed from, you know, across the other side of that chain link fence?
Well, she was worldly and well-read and well-traveled, and she loved music. She was very well-educated, 6 years at the School of the Art Institute. She was also not exactly a recluse, but she chose to use her time in very rigid discipline ways. She plotted out a daily schedule for herself and stuck to it almost all of the time, with definite times allotted to various activities. There would be working in the yard, there'd be painting, there'd be an hour of guitar practice. For a few years, she studied elocution. So she had a very very disciplined lifestyle. And it often was to the exclusion of contact with people. She was friendly, and I think kindly, and if people were respectful, she invited them into her yard and as well as into her house. So she was a fascinating person, a curious person, and I've never met anyone who was more disciplined than she. She was completely dedicated to her art, driven to make art.
So since she passed away in 2001, there's been some controversy surrounding her house and what to do with it. Can you give us a sense of what's happened to the house?
Well, since her death in 2001, the John Michael Kohler Art Center and before them the Kohler Foundation have been working diligently to find a solution that is both agreeable to the neighbors and also honors the work that Mary created. And this has been difficult. The neighbors have been very resistant, really adamantly resistant, to having the house open in any way, shape, or form to the public. The Kohler, John Michael Kohler Art Center made efforts to they presented a plan to the neighbors saying how they would improve the property and enclose it in a different way, and there would be very limited access to the property by scholars and other visitors coming down with a small van that would park in a new parking lot within the fence, and the neighbors were completely opposed to doing this. I think the John Michael Kohler Art Center has been diligent and sensitive to the wishes of the neighbors. But in my view, the neighbors are viewing her site as, rather than as a jewel in the crown, a blight on the landscape. And it is quite different than the surrounding McMansions and very manicured lawns of the neighbors.
Now, I understand. I want to get to the latest part of the story. The Kohler Arts Center, I understand, will be taking the house apart piece by piece, relocating it and the sculptures and the art pieces up to Sheboygan County. That's the solution they have to maintain it. But some people are saying, well, the art is where it is. It's the place that's part of what defines it. So what do you make of that?
Well, I certainly understand the wishes of the people in Milwaukee who really feel kind of an ownership of this property. And, you know, so many people have grown up with it and are and love it and have and visit there regularly. And ideally, it would be kept in its place, the place where it was created and from the place from which all the images have sprung. And I certainly think it's my opinion that keeping it there would be the ideal in whatever form that could be. And I think I know of the plan to move it, and I don't know that that is a firm plan. I think that the issue is still under discussion by the board of the John Michael Kohler Art Center, and I would hope that they can work toward a solution that will allow it to remain in the place where it was created, because it's not just a house and a bunch of sculpture. It's it's a site that's rooted to and deeply connected to the land and the lake on which it was made.
And briefly, as we wrap up, does Mary Knoll still have a continued impact, a legacy for the Milwaukee art scene?
Well, she certainly does. It's not only this monument to her achievement on the site that she created, and also a monument to the creative spirit, but she was a very wealthy woman besides all of her other characteristics, and she was very frugal and watched her investments like a hawk and preserved her inheritance. So on her death, before her death, she had bequeathed her estate to the Greater Milwaukee Foundation. So that was $11.3 million, even though she made her own paintbrushes out of her own hair and used library paste to smooth down her bangs and did every other possible frugal effort that she could. She managed to maintain this inheritance so that now the...
Barbara, that's an amazing story. Thanks so much for joining us today. That was Barbara Monger. She's a Milwaukee-based artist, printmaker, and author who's written two books on the life of Mary Knoll. Yesterday was the beginning of National School Choice Week, celebrated each year in January. The purpose of National School Choice Week is to raise awareness about what some call the need for more educational options for all children. Here in Wisconsin, education is a really hot topic. There's a new committee in the state Senate that will address education issues, and Republicans have already released a controversial school accountability bill. We want to hear from you on this. What do you think about expanding education options for students in Wisconsin? Are you a fan of, say, voucher schools or public charter schools? Parents, what kind of school do your children attend? How's it going? Do you wish there were more options where you are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Terry Brown is with us now to talk about National School Choice Week and the status of school choice here in Wisconsin. Terry is the Vice President of School Choice Wisconsin. Terry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on today.
So what exactly is National School Choice Week?
Well, it's just what you described before. It's 1 week out of every year where we raise public awareness to the options that are available to parents. And it's a nonpartisan and a nonpolitical effort. And it embraces all the different forms of school choice. So in Wisconsin, for instance, we have our great public schools. We have district charters. We have independent charter schools in Milwaukee and Racine. And then we have inter-district transfer, open enrollment, which now is about 40,000 students in Wisconsin using public school choice. And then there's the private and religious school choice program here in Wisconsin in Milwaukee, Racine, and then a statewide program.
So what kind of events are happening in Wisconsin this week to promote and raise awareness of school choice?
Well, there's a number of schools and then local communities that are supportive of school choice having events around the state. And then on Thursday, we'll have a larger event at the state capitol at noon. And we'll be bringing in folks from the private and religious school program, the virtual school community, the charter school community, and just a number of students from those different sectors of education will be there to sing and to perform and to just talk about how options have improved their lives.
Well, what do you see as the benefits of having this variety of school options here in the state?
Well, because every child is different and every family is different in terms of what they want in terms of their child's education. And so we want to empower parents and kind of remove the financial obstacles for parents to be able to choose a school that they feel is best for their own children. And lots of parents are looking for a specific type of curriculum, or they're looking for schools whose character formation and worldview is determined by the parents but then supported by the school. So we just want parents to be in charge of where their children go to school. I think we can all agree that parents have probably the best insight on their own children and in which sector would best be utilized to to support the parents' vision of their child and that child's education.
Well, one concern is often that the more effort you put into alternatives to public schools, essentially it's a zero-sum game. You're taking things out of public schools where most of the students still are. Are we ultimately leaving some kids behind in those public schools?
Well, you know, the state of Wisconsin doesn't fund districts or particular schools. It funds children. And so even if for, you know, more than a century there was a monopoly on that funding only to the traditional public schools, that type of system no longer is desired by the populace, and it is no longer required. So we have great private schools, we have great charter options, we've got great public schools throughout the state, and we need all those sectors to be healthy. And anytime you have a little bit of competition, it always helps everybody across all sectors to improve their programming and make sure that they're really responding to what parents want for the education of their child. So is it the case that if students leave a traditional public school and go to a private school, will that district have less money? Yes. But the same thing happens if someone were to leave the private school and move to the public school. That district would gain a student. So I think if everything is working well at the local public school, then I don't think that they have anything to be worried about. But if things aren't perfect and parents are looking for something different, then they'll have to respond to those requests of the parents. Otherwise, the parents will use their own rights and abilities to move over to a private school, a charter school, or a virtual school.
Now, the Wisconsin program that funds voucher schools, this is vouchers for families to be able to afford private schools, has a cap of 1,000. Some Wisconsin lawmakers, 1,000 students around the state, some Wisconsin lawmakers have talked about raising that cap. Are you hoping to see that happen, and are you optimistic that it will happen?
Well, yeah, we're hopeful, of course, because that's what we work for, to make sure that, you know, really it's kind of a rather small number of kids when you think about the entire state outside of Wisconsin and Racine have only 1,000 spots available for the families across the vast majority of our state. So, yes, we're hopeful that we will see an increase in the number of families that can participate in the Wisconsin Parental Choice Program. And so we would like to see every family in the state have that opportunity.
Well, let's go to our callers. We've got Pete on the line in Mount Sterling. Pete, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think about this?
I guess I have some issues with this. I've been pretty active in my local school district, and I question the legislature presenting separate standards for accountability and for measuring a school's success rate. If it's a private school, they're proposing a separate type of assessment than if it's a public school. And then a second point that I thought I'd bring up is accountability. I work in state government, and I see the contractors finish their contract, they do their thing, but then they're not held accountable after that. And I think the school boards, local school boards elected to have oversight on the schools, provide a really good accountability that the school's doing what they're supposed to be doing besides the state oversight.
Pete, thanks a lot for the call. So what do you make of that, Terry, the accountability issue? Are we comparing apples to oranges? This has been a big issue this year and in years past.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an apples to oranges comparison, because remember, no one has ever assigned to a private or religious school. The parents themselves make that decision to enroll their child in a private or religious school, or to do open enrollment through the public districts, or to choose a charter. But specifically with the parental choice program, no one is assigned. And private schools have been accountable to their constituents, their parents, since they started. And so private schools and religious schools have to keep parents happy with the product that they're receiving, or they just leave to go to another school, and there's immediate financial consequences for doing that. So private schools are accountable to the parents that choose to go to their school. We participate and have, quite honestly, over the years, put lots of safeguards in place on the program where we've seen where we've seen areas where we need improvement in terms of accountability, like accreditation and financial audits. We have worked to put all those things in place, and so I think we just need to keep working to let parents hold schools accountable, no matter what the particular sector that school is in.
But wouldn't it make sense to have all schools? I mean, if we're going to have accountability measures, wouldn't it make sense to have all schools use the same ones, whether that's student testing, teacher evaluation, you name it, and then the parents acting as consumer can look at their public school, their charter school, their voucher school, whatever, and compare apples to apples in that case?
Yeah, absolutely. That's we are in favor of that. So we will be participating in the report card system that can provide information on any publicly funded student throughout the state and what school they go to and how that school is doing with those particular students. So we will be participating in that, and it's just a matter of having enough data available, enough years for the state to produce a report card for those schools that choose to participate in the parental choice program. But we don't want to create a second public school system. We have a public school system that works very well doing what it does. But it doesn't make any sense for us to just repeat the same set of regulations and move that on to the private schools, because that it's supposed to be a different option. They're supposed to function differently and respond differently to parents than the traditional public school.
We're talking to Terry Brown of School Choice Wisconsin about National School Choice Week. It kicked off yesterday, and we're taking your calls. What do you think about school choice? Do you want to see more options, more charter schools in your area, more support, maybe state vouchers for private schools in your part of the state? Teachers, what do you think about this, whether you teach at a public school, a charter, a voucher school? Parents, what kind of options do you want for your kids? We're continuing our conversation now with Terry Brown of School Choice Wisconsin, talking about National School Choice Week, which kicked off yesterday, and the state of school choice in Wisconsin. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right back to our callers. We've got Darren on the line in Mondovi. Darren, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my comment was, I'm not so sure when your guests aren't sure that these two systems can compete. That's going to make them compete, and that's a healthy deal. But what if they are not able to compete with each other on a fair ground? I mean, I don't think public schools can compete with private or charter schools or whatever. And then my second comment is, I think the public school needs a lot of work in Wisconsin. I'm a 23-year-old male, and in my experience, you know, I'm a smart individual, but the public school, it fails a lot of people. I've witnessed it fail a lot of people. There's a standard model, and it doesn't deviate from that at all. And I think we need to focus more on our public schools than choosing other schools. Let the parents who want to send their students there pay that money and not use their tax money.
Darren, thanks for the call. So Terry, Darren worried about the public schools, but he says the solution is fix the public schools, not put more into options to them.
Well, you know, the private schools in the parental choice program receive significantly less funding than the traditional public schools receive from the state and local taxpayers. So I think there's plenty of resources for the schools, the traditional public schools, to work on improvement and work on parent satisfaction. So it just doesn't seem to me like any parent should be required to go to a particular school. If we are all paying taxes, then those tax dollars should be directed by the parent to the school that they think works best for their child. And then those schools will then be accountable to the parents. And that will do more than any report card. The key here is to make sure that every school and every sector is beholden to the parent and the success of the students in that school, according to the parent's vision for that success.
Terry, before we get back to callers, how would you compare the state of school choice in Wisconsin to other states around the country?
Well, we were the first program in the country in 1990. The program started in Milwaukee, and now it's grown to about 28,000 students throughout the state, 1,000 in this statewide program outside of Milwaukee, and we're seeing with about 150 schools. So we've traditionally been the largest choice program using vouchers in the country, but we've had some from some states. Louisiana is a nice statewide program, and Indiana will probably surpass Wisconsin this year in terms of the size of their voucher program. I'm actually in Minnesota right now, so I will be meeting with folks who are interested in school choice here in Minnesota. So we just see this spreading all over the country. We have about 18 states with voucher programs, and more to come as parents realize this opportunity to determine the course of their child's education.
Back to our callers now. We're talking to Terry Brown, Vice President of School Choice Wisconsin. We've got Ellen on the line in Milwaukee. Ellen, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I would just like the guest to address private schools' flexibility in accepting or not accepting a student attending their school. I always feel like whether it's for special needs or other issues, private schools have that ability to say no, where public schools need to accept every student.
Ellen, thanks for that call. Is that a problem, Terry?
No, Ellen, I hear that around the state quite a bit, but the reality is that when a student applies to participate in a parental choice program, the only denial for that child can be that they weren't a resident of the particular district. So in the statewide program, they'd have to be a resident of the state of Wisconsin, and they have to be within certain income guidelines. Those are the only two ways that a child cannot receive a voucher for which they've qualified. Now, the reality is that we would like to serve more special needs children throughout the state, and we work every legislative session to provide a voucher amount that will help and assist with working with special needs children. But we think there's about 8-9% of the kids in our schools right now have a need, and we'd like to serve more. But of course, we are blocked each session by the School Administrators Association and the School Boards Association and the public school structure. So on the one hand, we can be criticized for not serving more. We'd like to, but it's repeatedly blocked at the legislative level.
Ellen, thanks for the call. Go to Mark in Cottage Grove now. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. One point that I wanted to raise is, if you look at colleges these days, I mean, I went to college at a pretty key time where you went from dorms that were about 10 by 10 in a bunk bed to these kind of elaborate suites. And I found that people coming into school, they looked at these dorm suites and they were more excited by that than the education they were getting. And they were more excited by the look of the academic buildings than the professors there. And it seems like now in colleges, there's almost an arms race of superficiality instead of depth. And I feel like if you introduce a bunch of competition into elementary schools and things like that, you're just going to get more elaborate buildings and things that might look nice, but is it really going to help the quality of the education?
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. So competition could lead to an arms race, not of quality, but of bells and whistles that can lure families to pick one school over another, Terry.
Yeah, I suppose that's possible with a certain segment of parents, but not broadly. I mean, the reality is that private schools around the state are very, very careful with their dollars. And they're the ones saving the copier paper that's been printed on one side for coloring in the kindergarten, the next day. So private schools are very, very efficient with their money. Even the most well-funded private schools are still basic in terms of their building structures and their athletic fields. And so I don't think the public schools are going to be receiving competition for those particular attributes of the school. I think that families with their children in public schools are looking for a good basic formation in academics as well as character formation and the idea of service to the broader community. So I think private schools will be able to compete on those fronts, and it won't be over facilities. But let me just say, too, that my own children go to the Wauwatosa Public Schools. So everyone in the state, no matter where we send our kids, we need healthy public schools. We also need healthy private schools. But the reality is that in most communities, there isn't a private high school for students to attend. So even those children who attend private grade schools will be in the district at the high school level. And I think if you talk to superintendents around the state, they're very happy to have those children who are formed in private schools come into the public high school. And many times you'll find the valedictorians and other leaders in the school have come out of those private schools. It's just a really great formation for young kids.
Terry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks so much.
That's Terry Brown. He is Vice President of School Choice Wisconsin. He was talking with us about National School Choice Week. And as he mentioned, if you'll be in the Madison area this Thursday, there will be a National School Choice Week event at noon at the Capitol. More info about the event they have at schoolchoicewi.org. Music and politics can have a difficult relationship. Governor Walker's early steps toward a possible presidential run have highlighted that. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the Wisconsin State Journal, the governor used part of the song I'm Shipping Up to Boston by the band Dropkick Murphys in his intro to an appearance this weekend in Iowa. The Celtic punk band found out and tweeted in response, quote, please stop using our music in any way. We literally hate you. Love Dropkick Murphys. This reminds me, it takes me back to the 2000 presidential campaign. Al Gore used You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet by Bachman Turner Overdrive. Band leader Randy Bachman was upset, not by the politics, but because he hadn't given permission or, more importantly, been paid royalties for the song. At the time, I thought the bigger problem was that the lyrics of this political rallying song were actually about a one-night stand. And the Dropkick Murphys song, by the way, appears to be about a sailor who lost a leg climbing a mast. So I don't know how it all ties into politics.